Welcome to Office Hours with John Gardner. The John N. Gardner Institute for Excellence in Undergraduate Education strives to advance higher education's larger goal of achieving equity and social justice.
Good day, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host for Office Hours with John Gardner. John Gardner himself, myself. And I am going to have a conversation with one of my oldest, which is not a reference to this gentleman's age, meaning longest professional colleagues and friends, a man I admire tremendously and with whom I worked closely for about 20 years at the University of South Carolina. It's a pleasure for me to introduce someone who's those in his profession regard him with the Latin phrase primus inter pares, which means first among equals, the gold standard for being what we call in American higher education a chief student affairs officer, or some other term that he will give us. I'm referring to Dr. Dennis Pruitt, P-R-U-I-T-T, who served as the chief student affairs officer at the University of South Carolina from 1984 until 2022, and has his fingers on the pulse of the student experience in American higher education, as well as anybody I have the privilege of knowing. So I've really been looking forward to this conversation, and I'd like to ask Dennis to tell us anything he wants, give us kind of an overview of his story, but I would like him somewhere in the earlier part of that, tell us a bit about his own college experience and some influences there, and then take it wherever he wants. So Dennis, it's a pleasure to have you in the office today.
John, thank you so much. And thank you for those kind words. It's been a good professional relationship we've had, and I appreciate this opportunity to have this conversation with you. Well, in retrospect, my life has been kind of boring in the same place all these years. But I'll tell you this, is that, we are who we are because of our upbringing. And I was raised as a Navy brat. My dad was in the Navy. We lived overseas over a decade. I came back to the United States and had to be Americanized. And that was a real experience for me.
How old were you then, Dennis? How old were you?
When I came back to the United States, I was 12 years old. Mm-hmm. So that was it was a little bit of a shock for me, having lived in Trinidad and Puerto Rico and Panama Canal Zone and Newfoundland. I spent 2 weeks at a time here in the United States, but really had to be Americanized. And so luckily for me, I was taller than most of my peer age students, friends. And so I got to play basketball and baseball, and I went to a small college in Savannah, Georgia, called Armstrong State College, which no longer exists. It was merged with Georgia Southern, but I went there to play basketball and baseball. And I also became student body president, and along the way got a great liberal arts institution, education, which was delightful, a delightful benefit. And after my whole career has been a right time, right place. I was at Armstrong State, and Henry Ashmore was the president, and having been student body president, he asked me if I wanted to stay and work as an interim director of student activities and orientation. And I said, yes, sir, I did. And I stayed at Armstrong for 7 years. I then went to East Tennessee State, where I was there for about 2 years. And at East Tennessee State, I've been there a month and found the president, Arthur DeRozier, found out that I had some experience in what we call then recruitment and retention. We call it enrollment management now. And he asked me if I would be a special assistant to the president and the provost and established for East Tennessee State a recruitment and retention plan. And I told him I would, a right time, right place. And then I got a sabbatical and came to the University of South Carolina to get my doctoral degree, got employed while I was here. After 2 years of employment, the vice president of student affairs left and I was named the interim vice president, and then survived a national search and became the vice president of student affairs. Again, right time, right place. So I think it was meant to be, John, because everything in my career as I started through the career cycle just kind of worked out for me.
Well, I agree with right time, right place, but there's one ingredient missing there, Dennis, and that's you, the innovative thinker that I know you to be, and seeing what needs to be done to simultaneously improve the institution and the student experience. And you're one of the things about you that I've always admired most, that I think is a rare quality today, is the institutional loyalty. You stayed at one university for, what, over 40 years, Dennis?
43 years I've been here.
43. And you didn't have to do that. Why did you do that, Dennis?
I'll tell you, John, sometimes you're just the right fit. And so I felt like this was the right fit for me. But I've come to appreciate how much people's personal lives affect their professional lives. Mm-hmm. And I came to South Carolina, and South Carolina was good to me. I got my doctoral degree here. They employed me at a time when I really needed employment. They allowed me to be a generalist initially, which was, and I continue to be a generalist rather than a specialist. I don't consider myself intellectual. I don't consider myself a scholar. I consider myself a practitioner. And a lot of people don't take pride in being just a practitioner, but I think there's a role for practitioners in higher education. And the University of South Carolina has always been a place, an innovative place, a place where you could thrive, a place where you could contribute. Great leadership of the University of South Carolina. The presidents we've had have had average tenures of about 11 or 12 years. So there's continuity and stability. The executive leadership of the university has always been talented. I think we have 18 former provosts and deans who have become college presidents. So you're working with people who are motivated and who are competent and who are talented and fun to work with and who are stimulating each other. And it was a great place to grow as a professional. But personally, my parents, my dad had been in the Navy. He was from South Carolina. He retired to Columbia, South Carolina. All four of my kids went to the University of South Carolina. They could have gone anywhere, but they went here. They had wonderful experiences. My wife got her doctoral degree here. Columbia is a wonderful place to live, but the kinds of students we have attracted to the University of South Carolina over my 40 years here have just been students I could identify with. They're the kind of just, good kids who come, a lot of them, many of them first generation, many of them looking for that break in life. Many of them so responsive to learning opportunities, so responsive to the opportunity-rich environment we provided, so responsive even to the challenging experiences they had when they got in trouble. Just a really fine kind of student that I really identified with because they were much like me. And so it was just a good fit. And having a good fit and having a chance to grow and develop as a person, having your family close by, and having the opportunity to make contributions and to see the institution grow. I guess I'll finish this little segue with that. When I came to the University of South Carolina in 1978, there was a list published of the 10 party schools in America. And we didn't make the list at the University of South Carolina, but there was an asterisk at the top and it said the University of South Carolina did not make this list because this is a list of amateur schools. They are a professional party school there. And so to see us come from that reputation as being a professional party school in 1978 to the R1 institution we have now with the number one ranked honors college program, public institution in the country, and number one ranked university 101 freshman seminar program, 50 ranked programs, to see us attract the caliber of students that we have and see the programs and services and activities we provide, to see the way we change lives. And I've been able to witness that over time. And it hadn't always been incremental. There's been some chaos and some disruption. But to be able to witness that over time and to be a part of it is pretty satisfying.
Of course. Of course. Well, Dennis, you've been a member of what is still a relatively new profession in the academy. Some of our listeners may not know that, but you're the chief officer of a profession that is really post-World War II. And the University of South Carolina has a stunning national reputation, what is still a relatively young profession. Would you give our listeners just a quick flavor for what does a chief student affairs officer do? Why do we need people like you?
And why do we need a student affairs division is a really great question. Because in the old days, the president would select a faculty member that got along with students so they could discipline them primarily. And they'd appoint that person to, the dean of students. And since then, we've come to realize that we have a real role in higher education, both in the classroom and beyond the classroom. And I would define it this way, John, is that the role of student affairs on our university campuses is to provide an optimal learning environment where every student, every staff person, every faculty member can reach their highest level of potential. And in that optimal learning environment, it's our responsibility to provide everything that makes it magical and to eliminate or manage those things that detract from that optimal learning environment. And for us, that means we become experts in who our students are, and we become experts in our university environment and how that student and environment interaction results in learning and growth and development. And we help to influence the institution to make the kind of changes that are necessary to meet the needs of an ever-changing student population. And it sounds pretty easy to do, but it's pretty complex. You know, every year we have 8,000 new students come. These are complex creatures, these students. They come finding themselves, seeking identity. They come, trying to determine their own autonomy. They're trying to establish what their identity is. They're trying to figure out how they fit into society. They want to know what their talents are. They're trying to discover what they're going to do with their life, what their sense of purpose and mission in life is going to be. They want to find a person to associate with and maybe become a partner, a lifetime partner. It's a period of growth and development that's accelerated by the university in ways that we've only come to realize in the past 15, 20 years. And you remember the old days, John, when you and I first started, we'd go to orientation and we'd say, look to your left, look to your right, and one of you won't be here at the end of the semester.
I never said that.
I never said that either, but I know my predecessors may have said that. And so the fact is that we almost prided ourselves in survival of the fittest.
Yeah.
And the question back in those days was, is this student ready for college? Can they face the rigor? Can they do the academic work? Can they survive on their own? And now the question is, are our colleges ready for, prepared for, responsive to the kind of students that are coming to our colleges in order to make them successful? Successful graduates, college completers with some value added, good citizens, good people. And so the whole paradigm has changed dramatically. So student affairs professionals are providing that opportunity for involvement, that opportunity for engagement, that opportunity for adjustment. They help to establish the campus climate, the campus culture, hopefully a predominant culture that everyone can adopt to and adapt to, one that guides our students in their behavior, but also guides them through challenging support systems to do the kind of things that really allow them to take advantage of this opportunity-rich environment and to get exposed to things they never would be exposed to otherwise, and to learn about things they never would learn about otherwise, and to reflect and integrate that into their own personal beings. And student affairs folks on many institutions have become kind of the quality control engineers for the institution because we deal with, we're also the complaint department. So when you hear complaints, you start to see where the complaints come from. And are they organizationally related? Are they systematic? Are they individual personnel? One of my great delights at the University of South Carolina is my early years. We've had an ombudsman at the University of South Carolina since 1986. And we were an early adopter of the ombudsman approach. And in the old days, when we had complaints that got to the attention of the ombudsperson, I bet 90% of them were things the university didn't do well, did wrong, didn't anticipate needing to do. And now in 2022, the complaints we get, 90% of them are things the student didn't do or didn't do well or didn't do right and wants to be rescued from. I mean, most of the time we have in place the programs, the services, the activities, the interventions. You know, we have a philosophy that no student becomes invisible, no student falls between the cracks. And we want to early identify issues that students have so they can resolve them. We want to help them resolve it, but they need to resolve them. They need to learn and grow from those challenging experiences. And there's a whole science to this. It sounds like, oh, well, you know, this is just kind of, you know, handle it as they come. There's a whole science. There's a craft to it. And establishing the campus culture where we treat students with dignity and every student has their own path, individual path. where, in fact, we look at students and say to them, you know, we know you have personal circumstances that affect your learning, and we're going to understand those personal circumstances, whether you're a student with a disability or whether you are a student that has housing insecurity. We're going to think about that. We're going to worry and wonder about that with you. And it's remarkable, if you have that kind of approach, how responsive students are. You know, this is a generation of students who have a low receptivity to help, a very low receptivity to help, partly because they're self-helpers. Now, their self-helpers aren't always the best help they can get, because they'll Google it and seek a response, or they'll go to a friend, or they'll just ignore whatever the issue is and hope it goes away. But this is a generation that has a lower receptivity to help. But if you early intervene with students, if you early intervene with issues or topics they have, if you can help them take control of their lives early, it can make a big difference in their lives and the way they learn and their persistence and in their graduation.
Absolutely.
Dennis, it's a noble profession, John. It's a very noble profession. There's a calling for it. And there's a worry now, in fact, because it's a job that requires night work and weekend work, and you see some human suffering and you see students struggle, and you try not to, but you end up adopting their problems sometimes and empathizing and sympathizing with them. And there's been a drain on our talent. The COVID years really took its toll on the student affairs profession, just like it did the teaching profession. You know, we had people living in the residence halls with students who didn't know how really, how serious was COVID, and was it how transmittable was it? And if you lived in the residence halls, were you gonna contact it as well? We had students in isolation that had to be fed. It took its toll on the student affairs profession. So we have a very reputable higher education training program here, a higher education student affairs program, and students aren't flocking to those programs like they used to. Partly also because, I have to say this, the skills and competencies you learn in student affairs work are highly transferable to other areas of our society. Yep. And many of our individuals gain these skills, and they go and they make much better living, much better working conditions, much better benefits. And so the privilege of working at a university and having a calling is being superseded by the basic necessities of life, making a good living and having good working conditions. And it's worrisome, because we have relied on these student affairs professionals and graduate students and undergraduate volunteers and peer advisors to really run a lot of the universities that we operate.
I have been concerned seeing how many of my former students in the program that you referenced, the Master's in Doctoral Higher Ed program at the University of South Carolina. I taught one course a year in that program for about a dozen years, kept in touch with my former students like you have, and an awful lot of them have left the academy. Mm-hmm. And they've talked to me about, hey, no weekend work, nobody calls me in the evening, and I'm rewarded for productivity, competence, the criteria for advancement is more objective. And I don't know. I am very concerned about this. So what, Dennis, in the environment that you control, what are you doing about that? How are you trying to address that?
Well, we say this is one of those, this is a situation that's seeking a solution. It's mm-hmm. a situation that's seeking a solution. And my fear is, in part, is we're going to avoid it, because one of the things that many institutions are looking to do is, rather than rely on professional staff, rely on that undergraduate to help run the institution, to run the residence halls and some of the student activity programs. And we have to have professionals at the head of these programs. We just have to have them running them. So for us, you know, we have had a really an award-winning professional development program. We are trying to give students, trying to give our professional staff an opportunity for growth and development to help them understand how they're contributing to something that's larger than themselves, to give them clear paths for advancement, clear opportunities for a career, not just a job, but for a career and a long-term career. I don't know that people stay in institutions the same length of time I have, but people have come to the University of South Carolina, established reputations, and have had great opportunities for advancement here and other places. Mm-hmm. But it's difficult because we're a state institution. And so much of what our staffs are seeking now, and our students are seeking when they graduate, is what's that paycheck? You know, do I have to have a two-family income? Do I have to work a second job? Right. And the working conditions, you know, how flexible can we be? Can we allow people to work from home? I mean, we should be able to allow certain individuals to work from home. So this is a situation seeking a solution that we have to put our heads together on. We have to figure it out. And it's going to require some process changes at the institution. It's going to require some different philosophies from state government about the worth of these individuals, how much they contribute to the advancement of the institution, and how much they contribute to student learning. I think it's the same thing you see going through with public school teachers. You know, and they're slowly starting to get recognized, slowly starting to benefit from the worth. And, you know, the COVID experience, everybody realizes now is that online learning is not the same as face-to-face, and that those students that are really having some developmental setbacks because they lost that year and a half or 2 years of face-to-face instruction in K through 12. So I wish I had a solution for it, John. We're trying to address it, but it's something that the higher education as a whole is going to have to address. Same way they're going to have to address the adjunct faculty and the graduate student dilemmas that we have.
Right. And the strike that's just been settled out in California, raising the salaries of thousands of student workers, that may have an impact. That's surely that's going to have to be a wake up call for more of us.
We just did a salary study at the university in hopes of getting some state funding to show how out of sync we are, not just with our competitors in higher education, but with the private market as well.
Well, you know, you talk about your challenges trying to do something. At least you're talking about it. And knowing you as I do, you've got other people working on it. You've got people thinking about it. You put together some structures to try to work on this. And I think where many places are, they just want to go back to the way things used to be, which is impossible.
That could happen. We're a crumbling paradigm in higher education. You know, the business model has to be reworked. The academic model has to be worked. The service model has to be reworked. We have to, I always, you know, when we look at situations, we always say there's two things we need to start with. One is we need to be able to look at things with a blank slate. It's so hard, but you have to be able to look at things with a blank slate. Secondly, you got to be able to look at things through the perspective of others. You know, you just have to be able to do that. And we are so ingrained in the way things are and the way things have to be. It's very difficult for us to process changes. And I'll give you what my mantra is, what I told all of our new vice presidents of the University of South Carolina is, we've got to look at self-services, both for our staffs and for our students. We've got to look at shared services. You know, we just can't afford for everybody now to have their own administrative assistant or their own business officer. We're going to have to look at shared services. We're going to have to look at standardization more so than we ever have before. We're going to have to look at
that was standards for what, Dennis?
Standardization. You know, we can't have 10 different CRM systems for every college. We could have one CRM system for the entire institution. We've got to look at capacity building, and we got to look at right sizing. And capacity building is that, you know, many institutions are going to get bigger. And right sizing is what's the right size of every program, every service activity, and the institution as a whole. And what are the programs that are going to be the programs of the pillar programs? And what programs are going to be secondary programs? No one wants to do this. And everybody's waiting for the crisis to occur. Now, the crisis may occur in 2025. It may occur through the recession. But if we would all sit back and really start to think about how to address this crumbling paradigm we have, and how we can modify it, amend it, how we can move it, how we can reimagine it and rebuild it and reinvigorate it, the words I keep hearing. You know, if you can reimagine it and rebuild it and reinvigorate it, we'd be much better off. But most of us don't like change or disruption or potential chaos when we have good status quo. You know, we'd rather have a crisis. And then when we have a crisis, you know, I'm not doing this because I want to, I'm doing this because I have to. Yeah. What I have to do is I have to have shared services or self-services or standardization. And those are hard things for institutions of higher education to do, where we have all these little fiefdoms across the campus.
What are you, knowing you as I do, I don't want anybody to conclude that you are pessimistic. You're fundamentally an optimist, Dennis.
I am not only an optimist, I am an idealist. I am. People around the University of South Carolina, you know, they say they have a bubble optimism no matter what. You know, I had a conversation with a gentleman yesterday who I've been mentoring, and he's supposed to have his job interview for this huge opportunity. And they delayed it till December 6th. And he was lamenting. And I said, wait a minute, December 6th, that gives you this much more time to research the company.
That's
and
right.
Discussion. It gives us more to get yourself in line. I said, since you've got to make a decision by the middle of December, I said, it shortens the amount of time you'll have to make that decision. And he says, yeah, you're always looking on the bright side. I am an optimist, and I'm an optimist for higher education, by the way. I'm an optimist for what we do and the impact we have and the value proposition. And I sell it every day at the University of South Carolina. I sell it to prospective students and their families. I sell it to legislators. I sell it to opinion makers. I sell it to parents. I sell it every single day.
And you call this an optimism bubble? Was that your phrase?
I think that's what somebody called me. They said, you know, you live in this bubble where you just, everything is optimistic. And, you know, our football team just had two great wins. And I kept telling people that if you lose a game that you're supposed to win, you'll win a game you're supposed to lose. And sure enough, we lost to Missouri, but we beat Tennessee. We lost to Florida. We should have won both those games, but we beat Clemson. We should have lost that game. So I'm the world's eternal optimist and the total idealism. And I'll just give you one example is that one of the things I regret about my retirement at the University of South Carolina is we have a dynamic president, Michael Amoritas. And you know Michael. Yeah. And he was here for 22 years. He was a wonderful faculty member. He was a wonderful department chair, a wonderful dean, as good a provost as we've had at the University of South Carolina, a dynamic president in Illinois. I mean, the University of South Carolina may have its best 5 to 10 years ahead of it because of his leadership and the leadership that he has assembled underneath him. And one of my great regrets is not being a part of that. So there's a little optimism for you.
I'm not so sure you're not going to be a part of it. You're certainly going to continue to influence it. Unless you block all your calls, Dennis, and don't read your email.
I'm trying to separate myself from the university. You know, people always say they hope they leave the university better than when they found it. My goal has been to leave the university in such a condition that it will be far better when I leave than when I was here. Far better. And I think we're in a position with the services, programs, activities, the staff that are here in the Division of Student Affairs, the new leadership, the new president. I think that in the next 5 years, what we did over the past 40 will be paled by what happens in the next 5 to 10 years at the University of South Carolina.
Well, Dennis, if you can't sell this, I don't know who could. I want you to share with our listeners some of the things that you've been a part of over 40 years that you regard as innovation, and what were the conditions that made them possible, and how did you work with other innovators to make those things happen?
Well, that's the key, John. First is that I've always been a change agent, I think, in a lot of ways, and I've always been a problem solver, and I've always been one to try to make the University of South Carolina a better place to be. But everything we've ever done here has always been done in partnerships and collaboration with others, and we've had great collaborations. You know, the University of South Carolina has always been known as a place where the academic and the student affairs units are basically jointly that have joint endeavors. I have to give attribution to all those individuals in the faculty and in the academic and associate deans and the Division of Student Affairs employees, many of our students who drove innovation, many of them who drove changes. And there's been so many. I mean, I would hardly know where to start. I'll give you a couple just off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'd like that.
Yeah. One is, you know, this Carolinian Creed idea that we had in the late 80s. Because, you know, in the late 80s, we were starting to have speech codes. We had, at the University of South Carolina in 1955, we had one rule. And the rule said, a student at the University of South Carolina will engage in no behavior that brings dishonor to their fellow man. Now, there were women here, but it still held that language. You know, a student would engage in no behavior that brought dishonor to their fellow man. In 1985, we had 155 pages of rules in fine print. We didn't even print all the rules. We just printed the title, the rules, the synopsis, because we had all these rules and regulations telling students what not to do. And so we came up with this approach, and we came up with this approach by doing George Kuhn's cultural audits. You know, we did an audit of our African-American population. We did one of our women. We did one of our international students. We did one of our first-generational students. We did a whole series of cultural audits, one of our international students, trying to determine how we wanted to treat each other. And we developed this Carolinian Creed after a two-year study. And the Carolinian Creed, it didn't tell people what not to do. It presented a series of aspirational statements about how we should behave and how we should treat each other. And this is the way we behave in a community of scholars. And it got wonderful traction, and it's become socialized as a part of our institution, but partly because we have driven it all these years. I'll give you an example. You know, every year we have a freshman convocation. We start the convocation. The president of the student body gets up and reads the Carolinian Creed.
Well,
yeah. We have a member of the freshman class who's been chosen randomly. They come to the stage. The president of the student body reads the creed and gives that creed to that freshman.
Yes.
Their stewardship on behalf of the freshman class. And so that has really, we've had dissertations written about the creed. We've had, when students get into trouble, they come into the student conduct office and they'll say, I know I violated the creed. That's the first thing they say. I know I violated the creed. Well, you know, there's no penalty for violating the creed, but our students, it has become a teaching tool for the University of South Carolina and a tool that has helped establish a predominant culture that's been very helpful to us when we have a disarming event, when we have an unsettling event. We use it as a teaching tool. And our students refer to it and they talk about it, and it's lived a life of 30 years old now. So the Carolinian Creed was one. I always thought that centralized advisement was something that the University of South Carolina ought to have. I read a study by the University of Texas, and they said that their entire student experience changed when they went to centralized advisement. And so for 25 years, I tried to get the university to move to centralized advisement, but it was decentralized in the colleges and no one would give it up. Michael Amoritas, when he was the provost, was going through a checklist of things and he wanted to address it. He all of a sudden became president at University of Illinois Chicago. And before he left, he said, can you put together a group of people with Helen Dorfenhaus, who was the undergraduate dean,
I remember her,
and do a quick study of centralized advising and make a recommendation to me, and I'll do it before I go. And we put together a 7-person committee and with experts from the University of South Carolina, faculty member and student, and we put that thing together, and he approved it. And before he left, he approved the centralized, and it has made a tremendous difference, because it's not just centralized advisement, particularly for our freshman students, but it's a whole series of standards and training and certifications for our advisors across the campus. And it's made a tremendous difference to our student population, and to their ability to get sound advising and get referral to the Career Center for good career advice. And that's one that was a joint institutional approach. You know, we have a program called Cocky's Reading Express. And I'll tell you how
Tell the listeners who Cocky is.
Cocky is the mascot of the University of South Carolina. And we have this program where our students go with Cocky across the state of South Carolina with little books we have, and they read to students to try to get them to be excited about reading and excited about the University of South Carolina. It's called Cocky's Reading Express. Well, everybody takes credit for it because it's been such a great experience. But let me tell you how I got started. It got started because we had this landscaper who worked on the University of South Carolina campus. And every time he walked across campus, you know, he wouldn't quit working, but he'd look up and he'd say, hi, how you doing? Big smile on his face. You'd always see him, you know, he'd wave to the admissions tours as they went by. And I found out the gentleman's name, and I wrote a letter to him just saying, gee, what a great representative of the University of South Carolina you are, and what a wonderful spirit you have, and thank you for spreading the Garnet gospel, and thank you for being a member of our Carolina family. And his supervisor called me and said, this is a nice letter you sent to this gentleman. And I said, well, oh, did he show it to you? He said, oh yeah, he showed it to me. He can't read. I said, he can't read. He said, no, he can't read. And we started a very modest program, the town literacy program, followed, by the way, a financial literacy program. And that's how those programs started. And gradually, the students and the College of Journalism and others got really excited about it. And they took it over. And we yielded to them. And they took it over and turned it into something really, really wonderful.
Wow.
So, I mean, so many things at the university are a part of my heritage here. But so much of it, Jerry Kreiss, you get credit for that Carolinian Creed. And, you know, we had one of the first public-private ventures in the country with our Greek village. You know, in the late 1990s, we put together a public-private agreement where we provided the land and 21 Greek organizations built these beautiful Greek houses. We provided the land and the infrastructure. They built the houses. But we also structured that in such a way that we managed it. We controlled it. We collected all the money. We had money collected. We collected a percentage for the common areas and for repairs and for everything imaginable. We controlled the relationship. And Jerry Brewer should get credit for that, by the way. He established that. But, you know, we had all these opportunities to do these things for the first time. And we really were, I think, in many ways, you know, we were kind of institutional leaders across the country. University 101, by the way, John, you know, my small part in that and keeping it flourish after you left is that and finding the right kind of people like Dan Freeman, you know, and, you know, year after year, up until about 10 years ago, year after year, people tried to eliminate University 101. There's always somebody who didn't want it, primarily because they wanted another course taught that they taught in the curriculum. And it came to a head a couple of years, probably about 7 or 8 years ago now, we finally got resolution on it. Because we have, as you know, 50 years of data that show the impact of higher of University 101 on our students. And I have come to learn one thing, that assessment that results in evidence over argument wins every time with academicians. And when we started to present, when Dan put together these wonderful reports that summarized the impact that University 101 had on our students, the magic that it provided for them, the impact it had on their retention, on their graduation, on their use of our services, it was so dramatic that even the worst critic of the University of South Carolina said, oh, wow, we can't eliminate this. We've got to have this. We had an unnamed provost who wanted to eliminate the salaries for those individuals who taught University 101 and just wanted to make it a part of their job description. And that provost was finally convinced not to do that. And the program has flourished. As you know now, about 85% of our freshmen voluntarily take University 101, voluntarily. We have 290 sections of University 101 taught by faculty and staff with peer leaders in every section. I mean, it's just a remarkable venture in an R1 institution. And particularly for the kind of students that we attract, many first generation, many low socioeconomic students, many of those students dramatically, I mean, they just have they benefit from that program more than the data even indicates.
Of course. Dennis, if you were to choose, and which you could, I'll just say interventions, redesigns, causes you'd want to champion now that you have time to do that, even more broadly, that would take and require innovation to improve the student experience in American higher education. What would you focus on? You got all this wisdom and you've accumulated it at one place, but you visited many others. You interact with people all over the country and outside. What must we do that could be a cause that you would most want to pursue?
Well, remember, I told you for 25 years, I tried to get the centralized advisement.
Yeah.
So for 25 years as well, I've now been trying to get the University of South Carolina, and they have adopted a program of instrumental learning. Beyond the Classroom. In fact, we call it Beyond the Classroom Matters. Yeah. And it was our QEP 10 years ago, and it's our current QEP. And it's an opportunity for us to formalize in a curricular fashion the Beyond the Classroom experiences, to assess those experiences, what they do to add to and enhance the learning of our students, and then to record that in a next generation transcript that we record, not that the student self-reports, that we record. And we have this program now in place, and it's about to explode, because you will know, John, that the movement across the country in part is to vocationalize higher education, to make it a training ground for work. In fact, I only train those students that go into the high performing occupations. But here's what we really need to do. We know that a student's involvement during college can make a difference. No matter where they go, the more involved they are, the better they're going to be. We know the more diversified the experiences they have, the more broader experiences they have, the deeper the experiences are that last longer than just a paper assignment. If you have an experience that lasts a semester or a year, undergraduate research project that lasts a year, makes a tremendous difference in the undergraduate life of that student. So what, and here's most important, is that if the student's designing that, it teaches them to be a lifelong learner. In a world where students are going to graduate and not have a singular job and a singular career like I've had, they may change jobs 15 times and careers 3 or 4 times. They need to be lifelong learners. They need to be able to design their own learning experiences. And that's what this Beyond the Classroom experience, this Graduate Leadership Distinction, this My University of South Carolina experience, that's exactly what it does. It helps our students design their undergraduate experiences beyond the classroom to enhance their in-classroom learning in ways that incorporates those high-impact activities. But beyond the high-impact activities like undergraduate research and study abroad, globalization, leadership, community service, sustainability, social justice, all those kind of things, we now have other learning engagements that we know make a difference in the lives of our students. And so formalizing this allows us to advise our students how to take full advantage of this opportunity-rich institution. I'll tell you my greatest regret is this, is we do a next interview with our students, and we ask them the question, if you were to start over and do this college experience again, what would you do differently? Or what advice would you give to a freshman who's starting college? And if that student says to us, I wish I had taken greater advantage of the opportunities presented to me, we would have failed and they would have failed. The worst thing that can happen is for a student to come to college and not take full advantage of the 4 years they have, because there's no replay, there's no repeat, there's no redo. It's a once in a lifetime experience. And so if a student says to us, I wish I had taken greater advantage of the opportunities presented to me, we have failed. So we're trying to formalize this at the University of South Carolina so that we can formalize the college completion to career experience. And we're trying to get our students better prepared to be, you know, employment ready, to have that employability, to understand what happens in the world of work, and to create for them their own living learning experience. It's kind of a do-it-yourself education. And we're in the early phases of this, but it's already been recognized such that it has proprietary value. We know that other institutions are looking at this experiential look. You know, employers are telling us this is magic. They're telling us that, you know, the whole emotional intelligence factor that you're creating for these students, their ability to design their own learning experiences, the connection they have with the world of work, all these are the things that we as employers want, which means they'll also be donors to the university. Which also means our students will be more satisfied, because when they go to employment interviews, they will have a distinct advantage over other students who have not had this, this actually recorded, formalized beyond the classroom experience. And I think that's what I would spend my time doing. If I could come back as an employer, that'd be the job I would want. Because I do think it's the next big thing. In fact, I told our people at the University of South Carolina, all my colleagues, that the University of 101 put us on the map in so many ways. It gave us academic prestige across the world, really. And we talk about spreading the Garnet Gospel, but through it and through the Center for the Study of the First Year Experience and Students in Transition, we gained a lot of credibility across the country. I really think that this Beyond the Classroom Matters, this Next Generation Transcript, this college completion to career experience is going to be the next big thing for us and for higher education.
tell them again what the next generation transcript is.
It's a co-curricular transcript. The difference is this, is that we have approached this just like you would a class, John. You know, you have to go, you design a class, you have to go through a curricular review, sure. You get approval. Same thing now. We have these beyond the classroom experiences. You design it. It meets a whole series of criteria, very rigorous, stringent right. criteria. It's not just fun and games. Sure. You meet the criteria, you get approved as a learning experience, as an experiential experience. And then there's someone has to determine whether or not you met the requirements of that co-curricular experience, that beyond the classroom experience. And you may not have felt this because you're not on a campus, but there's now tension developing on college campuses between the formative curriculum and the beyond the classroom curriculum, because this beyond the classroom curriculum really does focus on learning, teaching the students to be a self-independent learner, to design their own living learning experiences, and to take full advantage of both the in-classroom and beyond the classroom experiences. It really is truly remarkable. It's a little bit of magic. It's a little bit of pulling together everything that we know that works from high impact activities. By the way, it gives universities a wonderful opportunity to look back and say, we're pouring money into these co-curricular activities, into undergraduate research and study abroad programs and community service programs and leadership programs and social justice and diversity training. And are we getting our money's worth out of it? Is it making a difference in our students? And this is because we're doing assessments on all these activities and we're doing assessments with our students, we're slowly starting to learn what works and what doesn't. It doesn't mean we eliminate a program. It means we become a learning organization and we take the information we learn and we go back and we act on it by changing and modifying and altering those programs in ways that make them better.
Dennis, I'd like you to do one more thing before we adjourn. We've got a wide range of people that are listening to Office Hours, different points in their career. But for the younger, earlier people who are thinking about, how can I make a difference? What's my agency? You know, what idea could I drive? What idea could I both become known for and help my institution, however they might want to frame it? What advice will you, please give some advice here as we conclude.
I'm thinking about retirement, John, and thinking about it. I am retiring in about 30 days, formally retiring. And as I have everything else, I've been studying retirement for about 4 years and I've looked at everything financially, socially, emotionally, I've looked at the transitions. I've done everything I can to think about it. And I'll tell you this, and this is a piece of advice I've given to some professionals here, young professionals I've talked to who've asked me a similar question. I say to them, I said, listen, as I reflect back on my 43 years at the University of South Carolina, I very rarely think about the achievements and the accomplishments. You just don't. And rather what you think about is I just have this restlessness almost, this uneasiness about what I haven't done, the mistakes I made, the topics that were unaddressed, the interventions that didn't happen, people I maybe didn't touch, students I didn't touch, or we could have touched, or maybe I touched in ways that, didn't work. And you start to think about everything you could have done and should have done and how you could have done it and how you could have done it better. And you really start to focus on what you didn't do rather than what you did. And for me, it tells me a couple of things. It tells me one is that you need to think about every day how to use your days constructively because they're limited. And even, the older and the wiser you get, the more you realize you don't know. But also the more you realize, wow, if I had just done this or I could have done this or had I done it this way. So you got to use your time personally, professionally, wisely. You've got to have a little bit of a sense of urgency. You got to have a sense of curiosity about the things around you. You got to work hard to connect the dots and to see how things work. You got to always think about change. We as individuals, we gravitate towards the status quo. We gravitate towards the comfort. Change forces us to learn new things. If you embrace uncertainty, it forces you to seek change. You have to be comfortable with change. You have to be comfortable with uncertainty. And you have to be able to take risks. You have to have enough cachet that you can take a risk here or there. And you have to be a champion. And a champion has to realize that things take time. We have this philosophy at the university called TTT. Things take time, and you have to take the time. you know, TTT, things take time and you have to take the time. And if you don't take the time and do things well, do things right, you're more likely to fail than succeed. Everybody wants a quick solution. Everybody wants a transformational thing that makes a difference immediately. And the other thing is this, is that those kind of changes don't come effortlessly. You know, a lot of the young staff that I work with, a lot of the students that I've taught in my class, they kind of want things to come effortlessly.
Yeah.
And when you push them to work a little harder, a little longer, they say, well, I worked hard on this. And I said, yeah, you know, and here's what I would have done differently than with the way you did it. You know, here's how I might have approached it. And you just can't expect things to work out without really working hard at it. And one of the things you have to do is develop a common knowledge bank for everybody on whatever it is you're working on. And from that knowledge bank, you've got to identify the topic and you've got to identify the solutions. And here's the last thing I'll say. I always tell our students is that when you're working towards an innovation or a change or a new program, people always, you can have a satisfying solution or an eloquent solution. And a satisfying solution, it meets the bill. It does what you intended to do. It'll solve a problem. It'll address a topic. It'll make things better. An eloquent solution will not only make it better, it'll make it better for a long period of time, and it'll take it to scale. You know, I have this bias about decisions that people make quick decisions. If you make a decision about an institutional program today, it ought to be a good decision today, and it ought to be a good decision in 4 years from now.
Right.
We're not like a chief executive of a company who's trying to get a first quarter return on profits.
Absolutely.
It's got to be a good decision, and it's got to be done to scale. It, wow. You know, you shouldn't be doing things you don't do to scale. Now, scale may be for a particular program, maybe for a special population, maybe for 100 people, but that's to scale.
Dennis, my initiating this series, it's all been worth it to hear what you've just said. Thank you. And let's say, I can't imagine that you're not going to hear from this, but how would somebody contact you, Dennis? How are you available?
Unfortunately, I'm public. Now, the best way to contact me would be dpruitt@sc.edu.
Okay.
They're going to give me a status that allows me to keep my email address and be involved and respond to questions and do whatever. So I'd love to hear from people. Love to have conversations. Thank you, John, for the opportunity.
That's the least.
A nice retirement present for me.
Well, I predict you'll be hearing, well, I know you will from me, but from others. Thank you. You have packed so much in here. This has just been wonderful.
Thank you, John.
Thank you for joining us for Office Hours with John Gardner. Today's podcast is sponsored by the Gardner Institute. And we wish to thank our guests and the entire team who make this podcast possible.